Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's good to have you with us. On today's show, we'll hear from Pat Race, Julie Copins, and Beth Weigel about Juno's Big Read. Danielle Redmond will tell us about all things heat pumps. We'll discuss end-of-life issues with Dr. Jessica Zider and Hal Geiger. And we'll talk with Zonta Kahini Middle School Assistant Principal Christy Germain. Those interviews, National Native News Writers Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon. It's currently 48 degrees with rain and fog mist here in the capital city.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Native community in Gallup, New Mexico, came out to support the family of Lisa Romero Muniz, who was one of the more than 50 people who died in Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas, Nevada.
And I said, "Josh, what does that mean?" And I said, "That means our children."
A vigil was held Monday night in Gallup. Caroline June Salone was a longtime co-worker with Romero Muniz, who was recently a discipline secretary at a local high school.
She was a very beautiful person inside and out. Her personality is just something that attracts you to her. You look forward to seeing her every day, just sitting in her office. It's just like you've known her your whole life.
She also had a connection with students, says high school junior Abigail Littlefield, who says they met when the student was in elementary school.
Miss Lisa meant everything to me. She always helped me without, like, really doing that much. All she had to do was give me a hug, and I felt like 20 times better than I did before. She was like my second mom. She was my mom at school.
The school district says the loss has shocked and saddened the educational community. Gallup-McKinley County School Board President Charles Long.
It made a great impact on communities, and even communities that are not in our school district. And I think what happened is a senseless killing. We don't understand why people do that. Maybe if we had a better sense of why they do it, maybe there's a way to prevent things from happening like that.
Long says right now they're working to support the family and community and begin the healing process. Meanwhile, police continue the investigation into the attack by a 64-year-old suspect who opened fire on people attending a concert on the Las Vegas Strip. The National Science Foundation has awarded Black Hills State University a grant of more than $700,000 to expand computer science education in South Dakota. The grant's lead author wants to work with schools in Indian Country, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jeremy Ludeman reports.
Ben Saylor directs the Sanford Science Education Center at BHSU. He says he received positive feedback at the South Dakota Indian Education Summit about the Exploring Computer Science curriculum.
I talked to administrators and representatives from schools that are on American Indian reservations or near American Indian reservations. And there's a lot of interest among people at that summit, and there's great interest within our project to engage those schools.
Lessons in the program include coding, app development, and web design. Saylor says 22 high schools in South Dakota are already on board. He says the goal is to implement the curriculum at 20 additional schools in the state over the next 3 years. The funds are meant to bring computer science opportunities to rural and traditionally underserved areas. For National Native News, I'm Jeremy Ludeman.
Native Americans rallied Monday night in Kansas City at Arrowhead Stadium as the Kansas City Chiefs played the Washington football team. Organizers say the rally was to educate the public about Native people and draw attention to Native American mascots. People held signs, which included the words, "Not Your Mascot," and "Rally Against Racism." Native groups say Indian mascots, including those in the National Football League, perpetuate negative stereotypes of Native people and have harmful impacts on Native youth. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. And by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon on Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and I have a crew in the studio now. We're going to be talking about Juneau's Big Read, which focuses on the novel by Emily St. John Mandel called Station 11. Welcome to the show, Pat Race, Julie Copins, and Beth Weigel.
Thanks, Scott.
Hi, Scott.
Hello.
All right. Grand architect, Beth Weigel.
I knew I'd get that title someday.
I love it. I really like it. Tell us how Station 11 came to be our Big Read book.
Right. Well, the folks at Juneau Public Libraries, where I work, we thought about applying for this grant called NEA, with the NEA Big Read, which is a National Endowment for the Arts project. And it's very similar in that the University of Alaska Southeast has a One Campus, One Book project where they encourage all the incoming freshmen and everyone on campus to read the same book. It's a common book reading. So we thought, well, we can do this for the whole community if we apply for and receive this grant. So we had Jonas Lamb from out at the university who runs that project program and a couple of the librarians at our library. We all got together and we talked about the list of books that are possibilities from the NEA Big Read list, and we had about three or four different books that people had read and felt would be something our community might get on board with and the kinds of things we were interested in talking about. And then we all left from that and visited with that literature, and when we came back together, we all were pretty much in agreement that we thought Station 11 would be the best fit for our community and be something that, since this was the first time we were trying this and getting the whole community to read, it's a pretty engaging book, you know, and has won some awards and people would recognize the title. So we knew it would be a gripper.
And for our listeners, if you haven't started Station 11, it's not too late, right?
We're just getting started.
Yeah. Who can give our listeners a plot synopsis? What's this about?
I can't because I haven't started it yet, and it's not too late. I'm going to. I'm excited.
I'm giving it to him to read on the
plane.
There
will be a pop quiz, Pat.
Julie, have you had a chance to read it?
I have had a chance. I read the audiobook, which I highly recommend on Audible. It's really well read. And I've read the print edition, and so I hope I can sum it up quickly. It's a brilliant choice because it pulls together so many different themes. So basically, it starts off, we're in Toronto, very professional, high-end regional theater production of King Lear, starring a Hollywood actor in the title role, has a heart attack on stage. And we spiral forward in time. There is a flu epidemic. The world as we know it comes to an end. And we catch up with a few people who we have met at that King Lear production show up later as part of a traveling symphony, they're called, of actors, musicians who go around the upper Midwest under very dangerous conditions, because you can imagine everyone's scavenging for food, no one knows if anyone's, you know, a threat, but they travel from town to town and perform music, perform Shakespeare, do something to sort of give their lives meaning again. And there are some very suspenseful scenes of peril and some fascinating paths, recrossing characters coming back together after time has passed and they've been through literally, you know, the end of the world. And then we kind of ponder what might be next for them. So that's the basic story. I don't want to give too much away.
Right. And I'll add to that, too, that so Pat knows why he's here.
Oh, right. Very important element.
Why am I here? I didn't read the book. Why did you bring me here?
That's a big question.
He's like the kid in class that didn't do his homework.
You guys set me up.
So Station 11, the title of the book, is a reference to a graphic novel that has been created by one of the characters, and we learn a lot about it in the flashbacks to the time before the pandemic, and then this text, this graphic novel, becomes a very important text to several of the characters after the world has ended as we know it, and they're in this new world, and it becomes sort of a guiding piece of literature, actually, for the characters.
Okay.
So the graphic novel becomes
it. That is why I'm here, because of graphic novels. Yeah, so as you know, we have the Alaska Robotics Gallery, and we have a big collection of graphic novels, and we're bringing a guest to town, Lisa Rosalie Eisenberg, and she's going to have a First Friday show this week. And she teaches graphic novel and zine making in Portland, and she makes a lot of her own comics. She's been published on the Nib, which is a really popular political comic site that people are probably familiar with. She's done a lot of her own self-published books. She's worked with a ton of different anthologies and print magazines. And so she's going to be here not only to display her work, but to teach a workshop at the library as part of the Big Read. And so that'll be on Sunday, and I believe at 2:30 at the downtown library.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So lots of events surrounding this book, and I imagine they're going to keep going on throughout until when, would you say, Beth?
Well, all the way through to the end of October, and this weekend is an action-packed weekend as far as events go. So not only do we have the graphic novel workshop, drawing workshop that Pat mentioned, but Julie's directing a full reading of King Lear, and she's also doing another really intriguing that I want to hear more about, reading of what we're calling Signals from Station 11. So there's lots of popular culture references in this book as well, because these are things that are gone now, and so she's pulled together some really great ideas for readings.
What are the details on that, Julie?
Right, so the King Lear reading will start 1 o'clock on Saturday at the New State Museum, and it's, I have to tell you, it's a dream cast, and I love doing these sort of one day, one and off readings, because you can assemble actors who are way too busy. They're in demand. We could never get them for a full production because they're too busy and they're too expensive, but they are volunteering their time. People like Bruce Rogers from Fairbanks, Jake Wade, Roblin Davis, Aaron Moore, Theater in the Rough. I mean, some fantastic local players are going to read these roles, and we are pulling in some community members as well, non-actors, but who have Shakespeare enthusiasm, and we're leaving a few parts open. So if you show up on Saturday and you're feeling brave, I will pull you up and give you a book, and you can read along with us. So that's Saturday. On Sunday,
start?
1 o'clock.
Okay.
And then on Sunday in the downtown library, starting at 12:30, we're going to do the Signals program that Beth talked about, which is kind of a compilation of, we're going to do some read some actual excerpts from the novel that leap off into other literary works. Everything from, we have an episode from Star Trek Voyager that's referenced in the book. There's a scene from Midsummer Night's Dream, another Shakespeare play that comes up. There's references to Calvin and Hobbes, Spaceman Spiff. We might present a little bit of that. And a scene from Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. It's a different author, but a playwright who envisioned a similar situation after the apocalypse. Actors are out there. What do they do? And in this case, they do episodes of The Simpsons. So we're going to do a scene from that as well. It's going to be a really fun afternoon of reading, starting at 12:30 downtown library.
Right. And then we also wove into all this some really fun post-apocalyptic type of movies. And at the Gold Town, you can check that out at 4:30 on Sunday. There'll be La Jetée, which is 1962 precursor film that was made. That's basically 12 monkeys, right? So it's something that was the inspiration for 12 monkeys, and so we're going to do that as a double header, and then also Saturday night, the Young Company over at Perseverance Theater is doing A Midsummer Night's Dream, and the library has underwritten the performance Saturday night, so it's free for anybody to come that night.
Wow. Pat, tell us more about the graphic novel workshop with your artists.
Oh, yeah. So it will be it's open for all ages. Anyone's welcome to join us. She's worked with all ages before, but I think we'll primarily focus on kids and teens who are interested in exploring themes of like both cultural and emotional survival that kind of ties in with the theme of the book. So it's a good way to kind of learn how to communicate some things that you might be thinking about and not sure quite how to share. So it's a different form of writing. Creating graphic novels is kind of a nice visual narrative.
And remind us time and place of that?
Oh, yeah. So it's going to be at 2:30 at the Downtown Library on Sunday.
Okay.
So basically following up the signals reading. So you could come for the whole program if you want and have make a whole day of it.
Right.
Where would be the best place to see all of these times and places?
Right. So we have a special website that Jonas set up for us for this that tells you a little bit more about the book and the grant and everything as well as the events, and that's bigreadjuno.org, or you can visit the library's calendar as well, and we have all the events listed there. And again, I just want to thank the National Endowment for the Arts and Arts Midwest for the support for this program. We're having a great time this month. You can get a free book at any library, download it from Alaska Digital Media. I'm also dropping some copies off today at Bartlett Regional Hospital and the Public Health Center because, you know, preparedness and kind of protecting yourself from getting the flu is also one of our goals with this reading and this program. So we don't need any pandemics. So get your flu shots, get a free book.
Wash your hands.
And join us for all the fun big read things that will be happening all month long.
And just sticking with the book for a second here, I think I read somewhere that it's received acclaim because it looks at the post-apocalypse through sort of an artistic lens where, you know, we're sort of used to zombies and all of that.
There are no zombies in this
movie. No zombies, just artists, mm-hmm. right?
And regular people
who
become artists or who don't, but who appreciate.
Sorry, I hope I didn't spoil it, Pat.
I don't feel like it's spoiled.
He's like, no zombies.
No. In fact, I'm beginning to suspect if you read it.
Yeah, I think that the notion that there is all this different artistic lens that's provided for us to look through as something that happens after the world has ended as we know it or civilization ends as we know it. You know, I think if you have an instrument and you have stories that you can build community and you can come together and heal from traumatic and awful events that happen in the world that are happening in our world even now. So.
Okay, lots of great stuff going on around this novel. Give us the website once more, please, Beth.
BigReadJuno.org.
All right, Julie, Beth, and Pat, thank you all for coming on the show. Anything else you want to add?
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Anytime.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not a
Support for this programming is provided by Maria Gladyshevsky, candidate for the CBJ Assembly in the October 3rd municipal election, paid for by Maria for Assembly.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, October 3rd, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 20 minutes past the top of the hour. Here in Studio A now is Dr. Zitter and also Hal Geiger, and we're going to be talking about a presentation tonight at Centennial Hall at 6:30 about end-of-life issues. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. Hal, let's start with you. Tell us about the Foundation for the End-of-Life Care and how you found Dr. Zitter.
Well, the Foundation for End-of-Life Care at one time was hospice here in Juneau, and then Catholic Community Services took over hospice, and we continued on as a foundation, changed the name, and became we've changed the name a couple times before I was on the board, but now we're the Foundation for End-of-Life Care. And we have a mission to we're involved with education. We do a number of things to support our hospice. And I think the people that know about us already know about us, and hopefully the people that don't will see some of what we're doing. But around February, when Dr. Zitter's book came out, a couple of us read it, and we had a meeting, and I just said, oh, what would it be like to have her come give a talk in Juneau? And to my surprise, when I contacted her, she said, sure, I'll come. Her book is just a very beautifully written and very humble story about how she came to be a little bit disillusioned with what she was doing and her search for a better way to take care of the very sickest among us.
Okay. Doctor, tell us about the kind of medicine that you practice and how it led to this book.
Well, I started out as a pretty gung-ho intensive care unit doctor, really excited to scoop everybody out of the jaws of death and use every possible technology and protocol and high-powered medication on them, and came from a family of doctors who were pretty interventionally oriented. And over the years, the early years of my career, started to feel this subtle disillusionment that was insidious, and I didn't necessarily have words for it, but realized that I was actually not doing the things that I had kind of come to do in medicine, to care for patients, to provide compassion and support and ease suffering, but I was actually often adding to suffering. And so I, by very luck and chance and coincidence, was exposed to very early palliative care before it was even officially a subspecialty, and had a real conversion of sorts, and now practice both intensive care and palliative care at the same time.
Okay. And what can people expect tonight? What are you going to talk about?
Well, my main message and the things I like to talk about are giving people back autonomy. I think we've automated, we've medicalized our care so much, and even that of patients who are dying and seriously ill. And what I'm hoping to do and help this sort of national conversation to change that so that people actually get back the power that they've lost, and it isn't so much of a conveyor belt phenomenon of just accelerating and increasing care, but that people actually have a say in what's going to work best for them.
Can you share a short story about patient X,
sure,
who this worked for, maybe a choice that you and that person made together that worked well for them?
Sure. In fact, the epilogue of my book is the story of a woman named Marcia Green. Actually, her real name is Stephanie Rovid. She was an amazing woman who had loved her life, loved her family, and got lung cancer. And when she got it, she decided she was going to fight it with everything she had. And she was accommodated by some very willing oncologists who kept giving her dose after dose after dose of chemotherapy with worsening of her cancer. But she just didn't realize that, you know, that this wasn't a curable thing. She'd never been told, and she just felt that she wasn't fighting hard enough. So she kept fighting and eventually got herself so sick, didn't get herself so sick, but became so sick that she ended up in the intensive care unit under my care, almost dead. And when we, you know, kind of revived her a little bit, she and her family said, okay, bring on more chemotherapy. And I said, wait a minute, I've got to tell this woman something that she hadn't been told by the doctors giving her all of this chemotherapy, that in fact she was approaching the end of her life. And I gave her that news. It was very, very hard. It was hard to say the words, very hard to know that she was going to be horrified and shocked and devastated and angry at me, which all of which happened. But then a couple of days later, after she'd already gone to the rest, to the floor, not, you know, out of the ICU, I came to visit her, and she had actually decided to learn more about hospice, which I had recommended. And she went home on hospice and ended up having 2 months of a beautiful, beautiful rest of her life. And at her funeral, it was just a beautiful funeral with no regrets whatsoever. And I felt very happy to. That's a new kind of heroism, which is not only saving life, but actually helping someone save their death and the rest of their life. So that happened with her.
Thanks for sharing that story. Why is this important to you?
Well, I'm of the age that I remember when men first started going into the delivery room when we had babies. And this end of life is the other side of that coin. For every joyful baby that comes in to Bartlett Hospital, it's just a fact that somebody's going to be going out. And in the 70s and 80s, men wanted some control. We didn't want to be just waiting out there till somebody told us what happened. And so there was this need to gather some knowledge and be assertive and take charge. And I'm so glad for that in the case of the birth of both of my children. The other part of this is everybody's going to have to confront this, whether it's their parents or their sister or even a friend. It's so ubiquitous, yet it's such a hidden thing. And I remember my aunt, my great aunt, telling me that when she went into labor, her water broke and she thought she just urinated on herself because nobody had ever told her about water breaking. This was, you know, near the turn of the century, of the last century. But to me, it's a matter of taking charge of your own life and demanding to be part of these decisions, which we'll all be part of.
For people that are hesitant to talk about death, Doctor, and even some belief systems believe that, and even talking about it, we invite it towards us, what do you say to them, and how do you approach that?
Well, I mean, all I can really say is, you know, is tell stories of people who have and who haven't had those preparatory conversations and done some of the work of confronting and acknowledging death. And I see it all the time, that those families that have actually faced it and prepared for it end up really, for the most part, just having a much more peaceful end of life than those who are caught by surprise. And it's something that we see not only in my experience, but in the data, that, you know, people who tend to actually have these conversations, whether it's with their families or with their physicians, they end up choosing very different types of care than what we do by default when we don't have those conversations. They tend to choose less technological treatment and tend to have more experience in hospice and more support with palliative care and management of their suffering. So when people are informed and brought into the process, they choose differently than when we just go along on automatic pilot.
Okay. And your talk starts at 6:30 tonight, is that right?
6:30, Centennial Hall, the Sheffield Room, yes.
And about how long do you think it'll go?
Well, I think it'll be about an hour. If all goes according to plan, there'll be about 15 minutes of questions from the audience.
Okay. And the book title is Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, is
that right?
We have copies of that available.
And we should also mention the Netflix documentary, Extremis, which I found very valuable. It's a documentary about Dr. Zitter and her work in Oakland.
And it should also be mentioned you got to talk to Terry Gross as well.
That's right. That was you're just like Terry.
That's a really big deal.
it was quite an
media.
Honor.
We like Netflix and public media, but Terry's like it. So
well, it was fun.
Well, it's been great having you both on the show. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
Not me. I just thank you again for having us.
Well, I'm just inspired by Juno, and how could you turn down Juno when someone invites you?
Sorry, I guess I do have one more question. How Foundation for the End of Life Care, if somebody wants to be a part of that, how can they do that?
Well, they could get on our website. They could just give me a call. I'm in the phone book, or you call me at 723-3234. Either way.
Phone book.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my landline, but the number I just gave you is my cell, of course.
I'd like to invite people who might be interested to learn more to sign up on my website, which is jessicazitter.com, and receive my newsletters and resources as well.
All right. We will see you tonight, 6:30 Centennial Hall. Dr. Zitter, Hal Geiger, and company will be there. Thanks very much, you two.
Thank you so much.
Death none can excel. I hold the key for heaven or hell. Oh, death. Oh, death. Won't you spare me over till another bridle your tongue till you can't talk. I'll stiffen your limb till you can't walk. I'll blind your eyes till you can't see this very hour. Come and go with me. Oh, death. Oh, spare me over till another year. Oh, death, how you're treating me. You're blinding my eyes till I can't see. You're stiffening my limbs and making me cold, taking my body from my soul. Oh, death. Oh, death. Won't you spare me over till another? Won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year?
Support for this programming is paid for by Rob for Assembly, P.O. Box 32754, Juneau, Alaska, 99803. Rob Edwardson, running for District 2 for City and Borough of Juneau Assembly in the October 3rd municipal election.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon on Tuesday, October 3rd. We're right at about the bottom of the hour. Scott Burton, your host today. And in the studio now is Danielle Redmond. She's the director of Renewable Juneau, and also Steve Benke, who's a part of Renewable Juneau. You may also recognize him as Energy Chair of the Juneau Commission on Sustainability. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thanks for having us. Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you here. So we're here to talk heat pumps. It seems like they came into our vocabulary about 8 years ago, maybe longer in other places. What are they?
Well, a heat pump is a way to move heat from a place that's cool to a place that's warm. So it takes energy that's diffused in water or in air, or it could be in other things too, I suppose, and it moves it. It concentrates it, moves it into a warm place. It's the opposite of a refrigerator.
Okay. But, Steve, it's only like 45 degrees outside. That's not very warm. How does that work?
Yeah, it's but it's warm enough that there's, if you take that heat and basically concentrate it using a device that's called a heat pump, that allows, and of course that takes electricity, so it takes electricity to run a compressor that takes that cool air and moves it into a building and comes out warm.
The compressor.
And if you really want to see that in action, you should plan to come to our heat pump workshop, because we think we're going to have a demo model there, which you stand and put your hand on one side and you feel the cool air moving into the device, and you put your hand up here and here's hot air coming out of it. And it's a very nice, easy to see and feel demonstration.
And this is this Thursday, is that right? 6:30?
Yeah, 6:30 to 7:30 at the Valley Library on Thursday.
Okay. Danielle, you are the director at Renewable Juno.
Coordinator. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Renewable Juno. You're a nonprofit. Tell us more.
Yeah. So we are a Juno-based nonprofit. We just started a little over a year ago. And our mission is to promote local renewable energy in order to create a healthy, prosperous, and low-carbon future for Juno. And there's really no time like the present to work at the local level. So we're very excited.
About how many of you are there?
Gosh, our board is continually growing, so I think we're up to 7 now, maybe 8.
Yeah, we've got some board members. We're not quite clear whether they're really technically board members yet. But yeah, there's about 5 core of us, and we're actually looking for new board members as well.
And we have 3 founding members, and we're adding board members, and we've got over 250 people on our emailing list. So
okay.
There's a level for everyone who wants to participate.
Sure. Where's the best place to find you? Facebook or website?
Yeah, Facebook. We have a website, renewablejuno.org. You can email us, renewablejuno@gmail.com.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Back to heat pumps for a second. These are taking the place of heating systems in homes in Juno, boilers, you know, oil boilers, oil, you know, things that run, hydronic keyboards, things like that. These machines, there's a machine outside and then a unit inside often.
Correct.
Pick me up here,
correct.
Steve.
Correct. What you're talking about are air source heat pumps, which is about the last 5 years they've really taken off because they've been designed for colder climates. Heat pumps have been around for a long time, but they really didn't work that well in cooler climates. And now they've gotten the technology improved to, like I say, over the last 5 years, they've really become economic and work well in Juno's climate. They have a unit outside that basically draws air in, and then there's a compressor that moves that cool air, compresses it, and basically creates warm air that's blown out through a register inside the house.
And the alternative, I think you mentioned, Danielle, is the kind where you can bury it. You can bury the heat exchanger in the ground, but obviously that takes a lot more work,
right? There are 3 different kinds of heat pumps. You have your air source, which is kind of the most basic option for a single-family home. You have a ground source where you bury a cable outside, and that takes a lot more work and money to install, but they are slightly more efficient. And then you also have seawater heat pumps, which are usually pretty large systems that you wouldn't apply to just one family's home unless you have a lot of disposable income.
And I think that's what the new power plant across the street is going to incorporate, right?
Yeah.
That's correct.
That's going to be a district heating system for all of downtown.
And we have a local example out at the Ted Stevens facility, which is one of the earlier seawater heat pumps that I guess it's second of 2 in Alaska that take seawater and create heat for the facility out there.
Go ahead.
I just want to add, if and when that project comes to fruition, it will be the first of its kind in North America. And the one in Drammen, Norway, that they already have built, paid itself off in 2 years. So I personally find that very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about economics, this is pretty exciting technology. We're able to use pretty clean electricity from Snettisham, right? Mm-hmm. Comes into our homes, and now we can heat them. That would seem sort of maybe the missing link in sustainability as far as homes went in Juneau for a while.
That's correct. It's, I mean, Juneau is just a great place because, as you say, we've got this carbon-free, clean source of electricity, and it's a very efficient way to use that electricity to heat. Of course, we do have a lot of, in this town, we do have a lot of electric resistance baseboard type heating, which is what was in my house when I bought it. If you replace electric resistance baseboard heating with a heat pump, you're going to pay about a third and use about a third of the electricity that you would to get the same amount of heat with a baseboard. So it's really a good deal for everybody if you get rid of those electric resistance baseboards and replace them with heat pumps.
What would you say is the payback time on that? I know, I'm sure it varies from house to house. What was it for you off the top of your head?
Well, it really does vary a lot because there's so many different situations of the types of buildings and so forth. But a simple air source setup, a ductless type heat pump, often, we're being told, often 4 or 5 years easily pays for itself.
Okay. And I've seen price ranges from a couple thousand going up depending on the size of your house. Can you add to that?
Yeah. I think we've heard the install cost in the $3,000, $4,000 range for the basically a room-type heater. And then it really does go all the way up because if you want to heat your water, if you want to heat, you know, replace a boiler system, then it's a much more complicated system and it is more expensive.
Yeah, it really depends on what you have in your house, how big your house is, how efficient it is. And some people have chosen to use them as supplemental heat and just do, you know, one main unit in their main living space. And then, you know, for rooms that are smaller and closed off, they just keep the electric baseboard in there and turn it on when they need it.
I'll bet people can learn all about it this Thursday night.
Yep. It's a great opportunity to ask questions.
Yes, and we're going to have a good panel. Yeah. We're going to have John.
We have several people coming, including John Howard from Northern Refrigeration and a couple of homeowners. We have Jim Rehfeld, who's also a homeowner and an efficiency expert, as well as Gretchen Kaiser, who will be there to talk about financing options, because that's often the biggest hurdle.
Okay, so give me the details once more, please.
Thursday, October 5th, from 6:30 to 7:30 at the Valley Library.
And is there any cost?
Nope, free and open to the public.
And this is sponsored by?
By Renewable Juneau.
And where can we find you again?
www.renewablejuneau.com.
All right, that's the voice of Danielle Redmond, and she's been in the studio with Steve Benke. This is really interesting stuff. Is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
Well, we understand that you have a heat pump that you've installed.
I do. I have one coming in a week or two by John Howard, who's going to be part of your panel, is putting it in our place. We had an old heat, you know, boiler that heated our hot water and all around our house with hydronic heat boards, and so we're switching over. So we'll go to electric to heat our water. And then, of course, electric to run the heat pump. So I'm very excited. And the other bonus for us is it makes more space. Our boiler was inside the house, I think, as it is for most people. Well, that's clearing up, you know, a few square feet because the machines will now be outside. So I'm excited about that.
The other thing that people like about them is you get rid of your oil tank and your fuel tank.
That's true.
And here in Juneau, those of us who have had old oil stoves should be concerned about our rotting fuel tanks, and that's one of the things we hear from a number of people that they think about it when they spring a leak in their fuel tank.
Yeah, right. And, they sound sort of perfect. Is there any sort of negative side to them?
You know, there's always such a wide variety of applications that every house is unique a little bit.
I think that's the biggest thing is you really have to think through what you want to accomplish with it. If you want to heat just a room, that's simple and straightforward. If you want to heat water, and it's a lot more complicated, and the cost can be considerably higher. I installed a ground source heat pump 6 years ago, and I'm delighted with it. And would never go back. It's just awfully nice not to mess with having combustion inside the building and having to worry about the oil and fuel.
Sure. All right. Well, thanks you two again. 6:30 to 7:30 on Thursday night at the Valley Library. Give us that website once more, Danielle.
www.renewablejuno.com.
Thank you two for coming on the show.
Thank you
very much.
We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The temperature's rising, it isn't surprising. She certainly can. Started the heat wave by letting her seat wave. And in such a way that the customers say that she certainly can. She. Jump to 93. Yes, sir, we're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave. The way that she moves that thermometer proves that she certainly can.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, October 3rd, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. We have about 12 minutes until the top of the hour. In the studio now is Assistant Principal and Activities Director Christy Germain over at Santakahini Middle School. Welcome to the show, Christy.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. A lot of events going on this weekend.
Yes. The weather might not be cooperating, but we do. We have a big end-of-the-season cross-country meet this Thursday. It starts at 4:30 at Treadwell, so Sandy Beach, and our Montessori Borealis program and the Juno Community Charter School are hosting this event. So it'll include their teams, the Santakahini Wolverines, and the Floyd Dryden team. And we're expecting to have over 150 runners.
Wow.
So in addition to our Juno teams, Ketchikan, Angoon, and Gustavus are bringing teams for this meet.
Okay. And, you know, if it's raining, it just helps cool them down, right?
Exactly. I think every Southeast kid has run in the rain.
All right. Cross country. Tell us a little bit more about the cross country scene in middle school. What's it look like? How often do they practice? Where do they run? Things like that.
So at our school, they practice Monday through Thursday, and they have an hour and a half after school. And the city assembly has generously supported our activity buses. And so we're able to bus students home after that activity time, so anyone can participate. And we have lots of runs in the Santakahini area. A lot of times our students are running toward Fred Meyer, or they're going in the meadow. They love to muck around and get soaking wet. They actually have one run that they call their Navy SEAL run. And they're just having a lot of fun. We have over 60 runners on our team this year.
Wow, that's a lot. They must be in great shape,
yep.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, we get kids who haven't ever run other than just playing tag and things, and then others who have trained and done triathlons and other events. So 6th grade through 8th grade.
And it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but probably one of the most accessible sports, right?
Yes.
Probably should wear some shoes and, you know, shorts and a shirt and you're good to go.
Yes, definitely.
All right. So then on Friday is when the soccer gets going, is that right?
Yes. So this weekend we also have our soccer season for middle school is ending. So Thursday night at Adair Kennedy, so at Floyd Dryden, we have our last games. Our co-ed teams will be playing at 3:30 and 4:30. And then Friday, all afternoon, 1 o'clock to 6 p.m., we're having a jamboree. So our soccer players, and we have over 60 players on our Santokahini team, and Floyd Dryden, that has a similar number, we're going to mix up teams and run multiple games on the big field and just have a jamboree.
Well, that sounds like
a lot of fun.
And remind us again who all is participating, all the communities and everything.
Well, for cross country, we are getting out of town guests from Ketchikan, Angoon, and Gustavus. For soccer, we didn't get any teams from out of town this year, but we have in the past, and we're hoping to next year.
What do you think it means to the kids to have people come and watch them?
I think it's so important. They have put a lot of work into training, practicing, and just building their team throughout the season. They love crossing the finish line in cross country, making a goal, hearing the crowd cheering. It is very meaningful. Thank you for asking that.
Yeah. You've been in education for a long time. You're the assistant principal and the activities director. We all know how budgets are right now with education and programs being cut. Why are sports important? What do you see happening with these kids when they play soccer or they run?
Well, we often refer to them rather than extracurricular. We call them co-curricular, and that idea that is supporting the curriculum. We do have academic requirements with our students to participate and miss school, but really the team-building aspect, the idea that they are training and dedicating themselves to something. We talk about a growth mindset and this concept of grit. And if you apply that to our Navy SEAL run in cross country, you know that they are building and training and working, and they're helping each other. Certainly the team building aspect of soccer, where you're setting up plays for another player and the success of everyone is the success of the group.
Okay. Remind us again the details of Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
So Thursday, cross country at Sandy Beach, and the race will begin at 4:30. And soccer has a game also Thursday at Adair Kennedy, 3:30, and then a second game at 4:30. But the jamboree will be Friday from 1 to 6 at Adair Kennedy.
Okay. Christy, thanks for sharing all of this with us. Is there anything we're missing or anything else you'd like to add?
You know, we've had great seasons. Basketball is often a very popular sport, and our basketball season starts next Monday. We have no break. We just go right from one sport to the next. And we have a number of activities that go on at our school. I think you've talked before on Juno Afternoon about the Juno After School Coalition and the BAM program at the middle school. We also have at our school a culture club, a homework club daily, jazz band, yearbook. Lego League is starting next week, which is really exciting. And we also have just the BAM activities, a variety, outdoor leaders, Native Youth Olympics, guitar. There's a junior police academy. We just have so many options for our students to be involved.
And I don't know if it was you or one of your colleagues that's pointed out before in research how important it is for kids to be occupied, right? From when do they get out of school?
So our middle school gets out at 3.
So from then until often our parents seem to get home around,
right?
6 p.m.
is that target time.
And that's, I remember when I was a kid, that's when we made trouble.
Yep.
So if you're occupied with something constructive.
Yeah. And we've, you know, in the BAM program, especially they've had things like Safe Sitter, which then can be some skills students can use to get a job, be safe in taking care of younger kids. But it really is having, they refer to lights on after school as a national program, and the idea that our school is open and students have something fun to do.
All right. Santokahini Middle School Assistant Principal and Activities Director Christy Germain, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah,
anything else you'd like to add?
We would love to have people come and cheer on our teams Thursday and Friday.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, Shelley Delaney will be your host, and she'll speak with Tristan Knutson-Lombardo about this weekend's sale, dinner, and auction. Pat McClear will be here to discuss Family Promise and the Taste of Juno Fundraiser. We've got a preview of the Wildlife Wednesday presentation by Bob Armstrong about animal emotions. And Jim Heumann and Mercedes Munoz will talk about classes at the Canvas. Taking a look at the weather here in Juneau, it's currently 47 degrees with light rain, fog, and mist mixed. Tonight's forecast calls for rain likely mainly before 7 p.m., then cloudy and a low around 41. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Wednesday calls for a chance of rain mainly between 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. And showers after 4, high near 49. And going into Thursday, showers before 7, then rain mainly after 7, high near 49. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.